From the studios of Minimum Fun, here comes Vox Pop. It's a Thursday, October 10th. I'm Ray Graff, and this is it. This is the last gardening show of 2024. Our panelists are crying, but we'll try to make it through. We welcome Greg Ward from Ward's Nursery, Fred Breglia of Landis Arboretum, and Bob Graves of Vatican's Nursery, that is. Give us a call if you have a gardening question. 800-348-2551. 800-348-2551. Always a popular show. Better to call early or email voxpop@wamc.org. Fred, Bob, and Greg answer your gardening questions right after the news. Hello again. Welcome back to Vox Pop, WAMC's live afternoon call-in talk show. I'm Ray Graff. It's gardening today, and yep, it's the last one for 2024. Bob Graves is co-owner of Fatigan's Nursery in Latham, New York. Fred Breglia is director of the Landis Arboretum in Esperance, New York. And Greg Ward is from Ward's Nursery, a gardening destination in Great Barrington, Massachusetts. We welcome your gardening calls right now. 800-348-2551. Going to be a couple months till the next one, so you might as well ask. 800-348-2551. And you can email us at voxpop@wamc.org. Once again, the number is 800-348-2551. The lines will load up very quickly, so if you hear somebody hang up, that's a good time to make your call. Fred Breglia, how are we doing?
Hey, we're doing pretty good. Thanks for having us.
How are things at the Landis? You're wrapping up for the season?
Yeah, it's wrap it up is a good name for it. We're putting on a lot of tree wrap for the winter protection.
Oh, yeah?
So this is a good time of year to do it. We've got a lot of young trees, and a lot of the animals will start to get into them in the wintertime. So it starts off with deer. They generally like to scrub their antlers on a lot of the young plants. So just a little tree guard takes care of that.
And how high up?
We usually go about 4 feet.
Okay.
Because they're mostly just looking for the trunks, and they're rubbing them, the antlers on them. And a lot of the soft bark trees, cherries, alders, apples, they love, tearing them up. So it doesn't take a lot of damage to cause a lot of damage to a little tree. And then we do vole guards. We start putting on that hardware clout that we recommend to people. We do that every this time of year. Again, just on young trees.
Okay.
And, glorious colors out at Landis, too, if you haven't been out.
Color's nice this year.
It's really looking nice out there.
Nice color.
Yeah, awesome. Really classic fall, so doing pretty good.
Bob Graves, what's happening over at Fatigan's?
Well, we're wrapping up. We're still selling nursery stock. A lot of mums. Good mum year.
Yeah.
Nice color. Got some stuff that's still tight. We're getting ready to put stuff away pretty soon, so we go through and put sulfur on all the pots because the water is alkaline and it tends to make the soil more alkaline over time. And then we fertilize the stuff that we're going to keep over the winter.
Hmm.
So when it comes out in the spring, it's got a little head start. So we were still getting ready pretty much.
Greg Ward, and you at Ward's Nursery, sir.
Yeah, it's it's similar to what Bob was saying. It is still a few weeks of planting time, though. I mean, we're definitely in a nice cool trend all of a sudden. We might, at least in the Berkshires, we might get a little frost tomorrow morning. So bringing in your house plants, making sure, if you have some of those mums that are way out in the open where they're exposed to a lot of sun, you might want to consider covering them. After tomorrow morning, I think we have a respite till at least Monday. I think it's going to stay kind of warm up, and then maybe next week, Monday, we might have to do it again.
Okay. It is a really good time to plant. I think you guys will agree that a surprising amount of root growth occurs even when it gets cold outside because the ground is still fairly warm. And of course, last winter, it almost didn't freeze.
That's true.
We were planting up until and after Christmas.
Well, speaking of planting, et cetera, Evan in northern Jersey says, is it okay to plant northern grass seed post first frost or better to wait until spring?
Good question. It's not going to come up. Grass seed needs moisture and temperature to come up. You need soil temperatures in the 50, 55 degree range.
Okay.
But there's no reason not to do it because you get it done, and then in the spring, as soon as the weather's good, it starts to come up. So the seed does not deteriorate over the winter.
We've always found that traditionally, October 1st, you were starting to take your chances.
Yep.
That kind of turned into October 10th in terms of putting down seed and having it actually germinate this year. New Jersey probably still has a little time.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Okay. This is from Andre in Croton on Hudson. I produce a lot of wood chips from my wood turning woodwork. Can it be useful and good for gardening mulch? There's all sorts of wood types: maple, cherry, pine, Osage, orange, etc. Note, the wood size is a bit smaller than regular mulch, if that makes a difference. Extra note, saith Andre, I used wood chips late last year on a hemlock tree that was not doing well. That tree got lots of reviving branches all over and all green this past spring and summer. Was it the wood chips that were magic?
Yeah, so that's a good question there. With wood chips, and there's been a lot of research with different types of mulches, which works best in terms of tree care, plant care. And what they've found is that those arborist chips that they often get pretty cheap or free from the companies doing that kind of work on the side of the road, they actually are the better chip to use. And if you think of it, there's a reason for that, is that they don't actually, they're not like the organic bark that's shredded and so fine. It actually doesn't have the water capacity holding that that mulch does. And because of that, it lets more water go down into the root zone of the plants.
Okay.
That being said, he said small.
Do you recommend adding nitrogen? Because the wood deteriorates, it takes nitrogen. But I don't think it's a big issue.
Yeah, it's not. And that's another good question, Bob. So the reason why people didn't like to use raw wood chips for a long, long time was because in the decomposition process of that wood chip, it takes nitrogen. But if it's not mixed in with the soil and it's a larger chip, it's going to get that nitrogen from where? From the air.
Uh-huh.
And so it's not pulling it out of the soil. But if you do have small particles like sawdust, it's real easy to get that mixed into the profile.
Yeah.
So now all of a sudden it is taking nitrogen. So big chip,
good
I guess
point.
Moral of the story is bigger chips, really good. Really fine chips, probably
not so good
because they can mix in with the soil, and then it's going to do just like Bob said. It's going to start taking nitrogen.
But that said, in terms of mulch, anything you can mulch with, for the most part, is excellent for every plant.
Yep.
I mean, as the caller
I think his question on the hemlock was, it was mulched. That was good.
Yes.
That probably was,
And
it could serve more water probably in the process of that, and hemlocks like water.
Okay.
And then using, just to keep going a little bit, using those wood chips on vegetable gardens is certainly possible. You could put them around your tomatoes, et cetera, but you still should be fertilizing those plants because they're young and they're going to have to do a lot of growing. And then working that wood into the soil right now when you're cleaning up the garden is usually not a good idea because then you are running into the loss of nitrogen.
You are, and that's one of the reasons I don't like to use wood chips in gardens, only because it has a tendency to get mixed into the soil. And let's face it, we want nitrogen on a lot of those
shrubbery
plants.
Wood trees, gardens, maybe something else.
Maybe something else.
While we're on the mulching topic here, D in Cornwall writes, I've heard that volcano mulching is bad for trees, but I see it everywhere, not only in my neighborhood, but in commercial plantings too. Why are landscape companies not aware of this? Or is this simply a way to charge their customers for more mulch?
First of all,
what is volcano? Is that like projectile vomiting?
Not quite. They pile the mulch up around the stems of trees, and it hence looks kind of volcano-like in
shape. Okay, I understand.
And we've known that's been bad for
decades.
Yeah, a really long time.
What happens with a lot of these landscape companies is they got a contract that says you got to add 2-3 inches of mulch every year. Period. But you don't have to take it away.
Right.
Just keep adding.
Right. And
you see it everywhere, but that doesn't mean it's good.
It doesn't.
Interesting.
No. You want to actually mulch wide and not high. So 2.5 inches of mulch is plenty. And it doesn't, the ISA, the International Society of Arboriculture, says that it shouldn't even touch the stem.
Right.
It should be like a 1/2 inch of mulch-free zone around that stem.
You should be able to see the root flare.
That's right.
When you're done.
Yep. And the reason for that is that these plants naturally grow with root flares at ground level or slightly above. And if you start to put mulch on that area, a part of the tree or shrub that normally is used to being dry, those cells that have evolved there are evolved in a way that they don't want to be under constant moisture. Rain's fine, but if it's built up a volcano all around that, it's just constantly going to add moisture to that area, and ultimately you're going to end up with a bunch of problems, crown
tree,
rot.
Tree roots like to be on the surface. People say, gee, why are the roots coming to the surface? Because that's where they want to be.
Yep. Okay. Yep. Next thing you know, you got girdling roots going around underneath the volcano. So, it's in general, it's really bad. It's a good question because it's just seen so
everywhere.
Widespread.
Mostly commercial.
Right. How could that many people be wrong? But that's 100%. There's no question.
Okay.
They're wrong, and you don't want to do that.
Just don't do it.
Yep. I've been known to pull off the road in various different landscapes.
I believe that.
It's, you know, not private property, just public property.
All right. You know what? Okay, I do believe it. This one's from Tula. I take care of a flower bed in the median in Albany. Last spring, the tulips were poorer than they've ever been in my time. In one Vox Pop last spring, you mentioned about voles eating the bulbs. Yeah. When checking the bed, I saw what looked like a vole. So what could I do this fall before planting the bulbs to eliminate and get rid of those creatures?
Well, as Bob always says, you know, tulips are just a one-season kind of thing. And so the first thing I'd recommend is pull up all the old tulips and plant new ones because they do get tired. They get, and if you're cutting them down in the spring because you want to plant your annuals before they've yellowed, before they've, you know, finished storing enough energy, you're going to have a poor bloom the next year.
Ah.
So plant new tulips. But yeah, when you dig them up, you can look for some vole damage. If you're pulling them up and you don't actually find much of any kind of bulb in there, then they were in there and they ate them, and you may want to, by excavating and digging it up, you will disturb
what's in there. I
don't
even plant tulips anymore because they just destroy them. You know,
you put out baits, you put out traps.
Probably over on Manning or one of those streets over there. They have the beautiful medians. All right, one last question. We only have a minute before the break, and then we will hit the phones after that. This is from Jackie. Is there anything we can do to get rid of horseradish in our garden? It's taking over. We've tried vinegar, boiling water, digging it up, which is a waste of time. It always returns. Any suggestions?
I wonder if it's not dock instead of horseradish.
That's what I'm wondering, too.
What's the difference?
Well, they look similar. The foliage looks very similar. Dock is a perennial annual that drops a lot of seed,
and those seeds
are really fast at coming in, and you could have a tiny little one the size of a little paper cup in September, and in June it will be a monster, and the roots are very deep. So you have to dig them up. You need a really nice spading fork. That's what you need.
Okay.
And you got to pop them all out and just keep going until you get all of that root. If it's a horseradish, you should harvest it and eat it if you don't want.
Now, if it's dock, is that poisonous or something? Do you have to be careful?
I'm not a wild edibles person. I think there's some edible parts to that, but it won't taste or smell like horseradish, I guarantee you.
Right. It's not really used much.
You're the forager.
I've never messed with dock.
Okay.
So I can't say, you know, yes or no to that, but it definitely wouldn't, like Greg said, there's no way you're going to confuse it for horseradish from a taste standpoint. Just the leaf looks similar.
Well, if you're not supposed to eat it, don't taste it.
Horseradish, if that's what they have, it should be easier to control than the dock, in my opinion.
All right, let's take a break. 800-348-2551. That's the number. It's gardening today. Last one of the year. Here's a little T-Bone Walker for y'all. Hey, all. Fun Drive begins Monday morning at 6 a.m. We will continue until the bitter end. $1.25 million, that's where we have to go. And if you'd like to kick in now, the lockbox is open. We've been raising money in the lockbox for the last week or two. All you got to do is go to WAMC.org, WAMC.org. If you value the gardening show, guys are here every month for a long time. So it's WAMC.org. Make your pledge there, and thank you very much. Vox Pop on WAMC. Ray Graff with you. Now we'll begin on the phones, and we'll go to Bess, who is in Alfred, I guess it is. Bess, you're on.
It's Alfred.
Oh, Alfred. Okay, it says Alfred, like the butler in Batman. All right, go ahead.
Well, thank you for the reminder about the frost, and that's kind of what this question's about. I bought a beautiful passion flower plant, and I kept it in a pot outside all summer, and I'd like to keep it alive throughout the winter, and I've had conflicting information about this. Some say just keep it as it is in the sunlight, and some say cut it back and leave it in the dark, which is the best way so that I can enjoy this beautiful flower next summer.
I'm pretty sure if you have a nice sunny room, sort of that, you know, south facing, a fair amount of glass, it will persist through the winter at room temperature in your house.
It will deteriorate, which is okay, but it'll come back as soon as you get it back in the brighter sun in
the
spring.
Exactly. Once the spring starts,
the leaves you have now will discolor and drop off. It may not put a lot of new ones out until the days get longer in February.
But it's not going to go totally dormant.
No. And just once you, a couple of things. When you bring a plant inside that's been outside for a long time, there are, you know, very likely insect or insect egg masses on the plant. So treating it with a little insecticidal soap or horticultural oil a couple of times, you know, 5-6 days apart is a really good idea so that those insects, which you may not be able to see right now, but will suddenly see in December. And at that point, you know, you're ready for the holidays and you don't have any time
to do
anything.
Populations often explode when you bring them in.
Well, that's the
outside, there are predator insects.
Exactly. I was going to say the same thing.
As soon as it comes in, there's no more predator insects.
Right. So outside, you'd be like, well, this doesn't have any problems. But then all of a sudden, inside in a controlled environment, it's like an outbreak.
Well,
so
Bess could bring in some predator insects, right?
There's a good possibility that she'd be bringing some of them in.
Usually,
when she does it.
Usually for predator insects, you want to know exactly what's hatching out, so you have to wait to see them. So, whereas the things I mentioned, they're organic, they're going to work really well, and they don't take too much time. Also be aware as you bring it in that the it probably won't need as much moisture. That you just want to watch how you water it, especially if it starts to drop a lot of leaves, it's going to need a little less moisture and just that balance. And
probably a little less fertilizer too, because it's not really going to be growing.
I don't think it's
just hanging on.
I would wait till probably late winter, early spring before I would fertilize it. But the water point is definitely a good one because it's what you were giving it outside is definitely not going to be what it needs inside. And then the fact that it's shutting down with deteriorating foliage, it's not growing a real lot. That means it needs even less, and the temperatures are generally cooler. So let it dry out. I guess we usually say let those houseplants dry out almost all the way. Not quite, but almost all the way before you water them.
Prevent root rot.
And these, so just to kind of bring it all together, passion flower is this tropical vine. Mandevilla vines, Chinese or tropical hibiscus, that thing called Brugmansia, big trumpet flowers, even your calocasia, your big elephant ear types of plants, all those things. Can be treated very similar to what we just described.
Okay. Let's go to Bennington, Vermont. It's Gardening Today on Vox Pop, 800-348-2551. And John, you're on.
Hello.
Hi.
Hello.
Hello. Go ahead.
Yes. I have had a bunch of peonies I've had for over 20 years, and they've suddenly started to turn brown and die. I've replanted new ones, and the new ones also have seemed to just turn brown and die.
So when you say turn brown and die,
way of fungus?
Do you mean like middle of summer, like in the growing season, it did that from the start, or are you talking about more this time of year?
No, in the growing season.
Okay. So one thing with peonies is they don't like to be planted too deep, and that may be part of the problem. Peonies generally like to be planted kind of shallow.
These were in for 20 years.
And they did good all the way through? Until recently?
For 20 years, they were fine.
Okay.
And then, like, the last 2 years, they've just been fading and dying.
Yeah, so botrytis is a fungus that's fairly common to peonies with a lot of humid weather. It's also stress-related, so if we talked about mulching earlier. If the mulch is starting to build up around the plants, that can exacerbate the issue. The humidity of the summer it's really good to see some of the leaves and to see exactly what's happening to the leaves or the stems visually. And it's probably a little late now for pictures, but if you had any and you wanted to send them to info@wardsnursery.com. We can take a look at those.
What was the email?
info@wardsnursery.com. All one word.
Gotcha.
No apostrophe.
Now, I would guess, too, they're very susceptible to fungal problems, as you say. The summer we had.
And what I put a ground cloth around them and then put mulch over that. Would that have anything to do with it?
That's not recommended.
So that may be creating what Fred was getting at as making them too deep. So that tuber that is in the ground, doesn't really want to be in the soil more than an inch or so. And then once you put mulch on that, you want to be very light about that. So now you have fabric and mulch. So that could be adding to the stress, which would then bring on the fungal issue, which is usually a thing called
detritus. We had a really wet year 2 or 3 years ago, and sometimes those fungal diseases will persist for years after that event. So it could be that it started years ago.
Uncovering them to make sure that the mulch around them is very light. Before you do that, kind of probing around to make sure there's not too much soil. You usually pretty easily can kind of poke around and find the tuber with your fingers or just a trowel, just gently find it. They should be really close. Mm. Cutting down everything that is foliage right now, just removing that completely. And then when they emerge in the spring, there are some fungicides you could use as a preventative before you actually see the problem. And usually that's in May before they bloom.
All right. Bob, you want to add anything before we go on to the next one?
Nope. I think we covered that one.
All right, John, thanks a lot for the call. It's Gardening Today with Greg Ward from Ward's Nursery, Fred Breglia from Landis Arboretum, and Bob Graves from Fatigan's Nursery. Let's go to Plainfield, Massachusetts. Kerry, you're on. Go ahead.
Hi, Ray.
Hello.
Two quick questions. I was wondering, is it best to cut back perennial ornamental grasses now, or should I wait till spring? And my second question is, clematis and hydrangea, should they be cut back or just left alone?
They're great questions. For the grasses, it's up to you. They can look really good for another month or even two, or until a big snowstorm comes and kind of knocks them over. But if you want to cut them back anytime now, you sure can.
Yep.
You know, cleaning up the garden, we've been saying the last few years, getting rid of as much foliage as possible so that you're not harboring overwintering little mammals and things is a good idea. And then with the pruning, a hydrangea blooms on old wood. Unless you need to shape it in some way, you should just not do anything to it. And then clematis, there's unfortunately three different pruning techniques depending on which type of clematis you have. And if you don't know, the rule of thumb is just cut it in half.
Oh, okay, Kerry.
Okay, thanks, Ray.
Thanks, appreciate the call. 800-348-2551 if you'd like to call the show. Let's see. Okay, we'll go to Troy, and it looks like it's Drea's turn. You're on.
Hi. I have a problem with my tomatoes not getting ripe. I grow like cooking tomatoes, so plum and San Marzanos and that kind of long tomato. The bottom half will get ripe, and the top half, like near the shoulder, near the stem, has yellow spots in it that just don't get ripe. They stay hard. I'm trying to figure out what the problem could be and what the remedy is.
So the first thing is, you know, we've talked about tomatoes, you know, the stresses of too much water, not enough water can cause both some spotting, can cause some variation in the ability for the plant to or the fruit to ripen properly. My first suggestion would be to, when you start to see them turning mostly ripe, is to pick them and bring them inside and let them ripen inside in a nice kind of a controlled environment. You still may see a few spots, but much less likely to get splitting or any other damage occurring. And so, you know, you can do that and just keep them inside for, you know, in August for a couple weeks, or whatever it takes. You know, in terms of you know, you could do a soil test now or in the spring to see what nutrients or you're missing, or to see if you you know, have a pH issue. Potassium is always something that might be a curative for certain kind of cat face sort of aspects to tomatoes. So it all depends on what's the soil got.
Okay.
Anyone else?
Anybody want to throw in here?
It's just that it's a good idea to harvest tomatoes when they get green. I mean, this time of year, farmers with a frost coming, they're going to go out and pick everything that's green, take it inside, and let it ripen.
Yeah, and we still got a little more time yet.
We got
year.
Time.
We do, although the temperatures are getting colder.
I've pulled all my tomatoes up already. They're in a bag in the kitchen here.
And
I was just trying to figure out why half of the tomato will get ripe and the other half wouldn't.
Yeah, I feel like that might be a nutrient issue. And so getting that soil test and when you send it in, you know, either to Cornell or UMass Extension, both of them can do that for you. You know, make notes about what it is you're trying to grow so that they're aware of that.
Yeah,
as well.
It's one of the best things you can do for your yard, really.
All right. Okay, thank you very much.
All right, Drea, thank you very much for the call. 800-348-2551. It's Fred Breglia from Landis Arboretum, Greg Ward from Ward's Nursery, and Bob Graves from Fadigan's, the final gardening show of the year. We got them booked for next year. When's the first one? February sometime?
I think it is February.
All right. So, you know, if you have a question, throw it in right now. Let's go to New Windsor. It's Carla's turn. Hello, Carla.
Hello. Thanks for taking my call. Love the show.
Thanks.
We have beautiful lilac bushes that we've had for about 30 years. They flowered beautifully for about 10, 12 years, and we would cut them back after they flowered. They would always come back, but for the last 15 years or so, just green, never flowered again, and we don't know why.
Is it? Did the site get more shady by any chance over the chunk of years?
No. I'm looking at them. They're in the sun.
So same amount. And when you say cut them back after they flower, do you mean like take one-third of the oldest canes away and sort of begin to replace those shrubs with younger wood, or are we talking another type of pruning?
No, we would cut them back on, I guess, about a third. One year we did cut them pretty low, but they did come back and flower.
Yep. So generally with lilacs, we want to remove the largest canes out of a shrub. So let's just say there's like three really large canes, or nine really large canes and a bunch of small canes, or trunks, if you know, think of it that way. You want to remove the biggest ones, and you cut them pretty much right at the ground level. And, you know, a couple inches above, and then you're replacing that shrub with the younger ones. So the biggest, you know, if you have to, and what happens is that plant will always be younger wood, and they're going to be way more vigorous and way more flowers.
Basically rejuvenating it every year a little bit.
Yeah, a little bit, instead of doing the hard rejuvenate, which you could do. But,
which you could do.
So I'm pretty curious that you were able to cut your lilacs by a third across the top and get them to rebloom in years past. In the next year, because maybe you were leaving some side shoots that still had flower buds, because what we're talking about are common lilacs, your typical, early May, Mother's Day blooming plant, and that plant shouldn't really be seriously pruned every year. It should be, you know, maybe cycled out, as Fred was saying, maybe every 5 years or something at the most.
Yeah, so in general, you're not really cutting them back. And that's why I said, you know, when it comes to pruning with them, you're actually leaving those long shoots, the younger long shoots, alone for the most part. I mean, if there was one really abnormally asymmetrical shaped shoot that you know, obviously you can cut that. But in general, we're taking away the big ones, a couple, you know, every couple of years, and replacing it with younger ones, and that should get you as long as you didn't change the exposure. But you said you're still getting just as much sun.
My experience with lilacs is if they're in full sun, the problem is pruning.
Yeah.
Because they're going
to
flower.
Has to be it.
I don't know how to prevent them from flowering.
No, but if they're in shade, they just don't bloom.
If they're in any amount of shade, they may not.
No, but they'll thrive. But that doesn't sound like the case with you. It's probably just, you know, easily correctable with some corrective pruning. And do it right after they bloom. And then the only other thing I recommend is that I like to take the spent flowers off as well. So I'm taking out two or three of those oldest, you know, trunks. But then I'm also taking out the dead flowers before they started to set seed. And the reason for that is a lot of energy goes into those seeds. And if you ever looked at the lilac seeds, they're pretty big. All that energy, if you just take that spent flower off, would all go to producing more flower buds, bigger flower buds for the following year. So, you know, deadhead your lilacs. So that doesn't mean take them to a show. That means take those flowers out, just to make sure you didn't confuse us.
All right, I got
Took me a minute here. Catch that.
You go to a lot of dead shows, did you, Bob? No, never. Okay. 800-348-2551 is the number. Let's get one more call in, then we'll take a break, and then we'll check the email bag. Let's go to Chris in Housatonic. Chris, you're on.
Yeah, I was wondering if you could grow papayas and limes and passion fruit in the garden.
Yeah, that's a new one.
You can, but you have to live in southern Florida.
Yeah, so not around, not Housatonic.
Definitely not the Northeast, unless you keep them in a pot and you have them inside from maybe today, because it's going to get cold tomorrow, until the end of May.
Hmm.
And then you know, lemons are pretty easy. Papaya and mangoes, I think, are a little trickier.
Okay.
Under lights, I suppose, you could get away with stretching that hardy, you know, the hardiness zones of some of these plants.
Do you sell a lot of papaya and such over
Not
there?
Not papaya.
Ward's Nursery?
A few persimmons, tropical persimmons.
Right.
Yeah. And a lot of citrus, though. Oranges,
yeah.
Lemons.
How about
limes.
Guavas?
No.
But there is one good tropical fruit you can grow, Chris, and it's called a pawpaw tree. Pawpaws are actually part of a tropical group of plants, and we have one species in North America that can live in our zone. In fact, it's native to New York State, and not only is it native to New York, it happens to be coincidentally the largest native fruit in the United States.
Wow.
And they grow well, and if you open one of those pawpaws, and it is pawpaw season now, you open one of them things up, and you definitely does not taste like something in New York State. It tastes like...
Almost banana-ish.
Yeah, banana-ish, mango-ish.
Yeah.
But, you know, that would be one that you can get readily available, and it would work, and you'd have tropical fruit, and you wouldn't have to worry about any of this stuff, Chris.
All right.
They're really good if you haven't had them.
Thanks, Chris. 800-348-2551 is the number. Sure, it's Vox Pop. Sure, if you have an outlandish question, we'd like to hear it. And we'll be back. Little Zappa there. Wow, Greg Ward just had a fantastic idea. Now, you know, we have no gardening shows booked into maybe mid-February, I think. We have them all set for the year. But Greg Ward just said, you know, if there is enough support here during this show at WAMC.org, if we get 10 people pledging in honor of the gardening show, we'll book one. When do you guys want to do it? January?
Sure. January.
All right, perfect. We'll do a January show. We need 10 people right now. And you can, I don't want to give the number for the fund drive because it's different than this. Go to WAMC.org and indicate you want a gardening show. Now, if you say no more gardening shows ever, well, we'll get the point and I'll fire these guys.
Yeah, but still donate.
But still donate.
That's a great point. And thank you for that, keeping me on message. You know what, Greg, we're going to invite you back for the fund drive. In fact, you can take my shift.
What are you doing tomorrow?
All right, let's go to Adam in Sandersville. Adam, you're on.
Hello?
Hello.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. Two questions.
Okay.
One is, I have a couple of hydrangeas, well-established, probably 10 years old, pretty big. I want to transplant them. I don't know whether it's best to do it in the late fall or early spring. That's the first question. The second question is, I have a verbenum that's probably 35 years old, 40 years old. I've cut back a few of the large canes. They're sort of spindly and tall. I've got a lot of undergrowth that's about 2.5 feet high. I'm wondering how many of those older canes I can cut back without hurting the plant, and whether that should be done late fall or before things start moving in the springtime.
Well, that's great. So the hydrangea, you can move spring or fall. You could do it starting today and in the next, you know, few weeks or month if you have to wait a little bit.
Yeah, and those do transplant fairly well.
Oh, really well.
Yeah, really easy. They got a nice fibrous root system, no large tap roots.
Or if you have to wait till spring, you know, try to get it done before they start to bud out. So these days, you know, spring comes early, so sometime in April.
Okay.
Good. The what's the other question?
He had about pruning.
Right.
So he has a viburnum that has a lot of old stems and then
a lot of shorter, younger stems.
So
that's right.
You probably could take out, if you really wanted to take out all the older stems.
That's what I was thinking,
you could take them all out and just let the younger ones come in next year.
And then that be kind of comes the new shrub, similar to like the lilac.
The only thing I would say with the hydrangeas.
So would I do that? So would I take out? So would I take out those larger stems now in the late fall, or is that springtime?
Again, both would be great. Either time.
Either one on that. Yeah.
With the hydrangea, the only difficulty you'll have is the longer a plant is in the ground, the bigger a root ball you're going to have to dig. So it just simply gets heavy to move. So you may need help.
Yep. And if you wanted to, if you want it, since a hydrangea would move equally well in fall or spring, you could go around sort of the area that you're going to want to remove the root ball and kind of root prune it. Use a spade and you kind of go straight down and cut all the roots, and you do it around the entire proposed excavation area, what the root ball on this plant's going to look like. And then in the spring, what you've done is you've severed them all without any real stress for the plant, and it just makes it a lot easier to, especially if they've been in the ground for a long time, to move it in the springtime without having to get as large of a root ball.
A lot of people don't realize that in a nursery where you're growing things in the ground, if you don't root prune it every few years, you're never going to transplant
That's
it.
True.
It needs to be root pruned.
Okay. Yep. Good
this
point.
Email from Dan. Fern question. I'm looking for advice on what kind of ferns would be hardy enough to survive the upstate New York winter. This is for a fairly shaded area on the edge of the woods in our backyard that we are trying to spiff up.
Yeah, you got quite a few options. Ostrich fern would certainly work. Maiden Sahara hair fern, woodland fern.
There's a dozen or more native ferns that would work. Pretty common, commonly used ones are Christmas fern. It has a lot of interest. Any of the wood ferns. So there's a New York wood fern. There's I lost it there for a minute. Couple of other wood ferns, and then there's lady fern, and then of course hay scented fern kind of creates a really nice mat as well.
Hmm. Yeah, one of the questions really there is how fern. Tall do you want it to be? Because some of them get tall, don't.
There's a fern called Goldie fern. Yeah. It's a native fern. You don't really see it that often in the woods, but it can be 6 feet tall.
No, really?
Yeah.
If you get some of that,
if you're anywhere near Landis Arboretum, we actually do have a fern collection and a fern trail, and it's all labeled. And this time of year is not obviously the time to visit, but in the springtime when all the ferns come up, late spring, summer, then you could really go, look at them all labeled and just compare it. And they all work in New York. Most of them are native.
All right, this email from Liz. I planted a lovely calla lily outside and it has thrived. Can I also replant this for indoors?
Well, it's not going to survive outside, right?
Yeah, you have to lift it. You could lift it and keep the foliage for a while. Usually they're left to go dormant, so you could lift it, put it in a pot, but then let it dry out. Mm-hmm. So don't water it consistently in the house and just let it go dormant. The leaves will discolor.
Sort of like you would with an amaryllis or something like that.
Yes, and then just store it in a cool, dark place, and then you could fire it up again in the spring.
Yep. Similar to dahlias as well.
Mm-hmm. All right, let's go to Ruth in Washington, Massachusetts. Hello there, Ruth, you're on.
Hi, I'm calling to find out how a person might winter over pepper plants.
Ooh.
Well, you can bring, just as we've been talking about, they're a tropical plant, so bringing them inside, especially if they're in a container already, that makes it really easy. And then putting them in a warm, sunny location, because they have probably some flowers still on them and maybe some fruit forming, that fruit will continue. But it really depends on what you have for the amount of light going into winter. So if you have a little greenhouse, then it can work out pretty well. But if you have less than that, they might just peter out. But you can certainly extend the season by bringing them in now.
One of the things people need to recognize when you're trying to do that sort of thing is in the wintertime, it's cloudy most of the time and the days are short. Yeah. So things are going to deteriorate because they're just not going to get them much light, even if you have a bright window.
Right. There's not a lot out there, even out in full sun in the wintertime. It's just, UV rays around here is not heavy.
And if they're not in a pot, you could transplant them now into a container and do that. And you use mostly potting soil. You'll want to take some of the garden soil, but mostly potting soil.
All right.
Should they be trimmed? Should they be trimmed?
No. I wouldn't do any trimming. I would just get them inside, water them well once, and then water them again, when they're dry, and just get the schedule down, whether that's, 5 days or 15 days, whatever it is.
Yeah. All right, Ruth.
Okay. Thank you.
Thanks a lot for the call. Okay. I swear to you, I don't make this stuff up. And please, if it's off the rails, just let me know. This is from Frank, also in Northern Jersey. Oh, God. I have heard it is good to urinate on compost piles, given the urea content and anti-predator benefits. Please comment.
I'm sorry.
It's a nitrogen source, but
I would not recommend that because there's a lot. You are adding nitrogen, but you're adding a lot of waste product in there, and it's just human waste is a lot different than cow manure.
All right, so I resign and I'm retiring. So that's it.
Leave it at that, I guess.
Yeah, that's right. You guys carry on.
There are commercially available or retail available predator urines.
Right.
There are.
So a little bottle of coyote urine or
I don't think human urine works very well.
No, really don't. No, but if you wanted to keep
not
something
that I've
away,
ever tried it, have you? But.
That would be the way to go. I mean, but it has limited usage. I mean, we've tried to deter woodchucks at the arboretum using like fox or coyote urines, and they came right back pretty quick. Yeah. I don't even know if they left.
Losing the will to live. Keith in Orange, Massachusetts. Keith, help me out here.
So I have some 100-year-old apple trees. I got pictures of my house from the early 1900s, 1910 or so, with these trees in it. I've seen on some of the pesticides to put on the trees, it always says don't use on mature trees. So I've never oiled the trees in the spring. And I just want a better idea how to take care of them, what I can do to keep the bugs off, because I usually get a pretty good crop out of these trees.
I've never seen that on a label.
No.
So not use
but
it on mature.
I've seen it on a couple there. It says don't do on mature trees. And I'm afraid to put some stuff on there.
I mean, it may be actively growing trees.
So there are some
products that are applied only in
a dormant
sense. But
you do a horticultural oil at the right time, you'd be fine. But it's the timing that's what's important.
It is. Yeah, and it does control a lot of stuff. I mean, is it going to be 100% no spots on an apple? No. But is it going to control most of your stuff? Yeah.
And there's some resources. Again, UMass Extension has, if you just go to their website and start hitting a few of the buttons there, you'll find some information on spray programs, on both what types of things to use and when to use them.
Yeah.
And it's all available right there.
Keith.
All right. Good enough.
Thanks a lot. I appreciate the call. Now, listen, Greg Ward's grand idea, if you're really interested in doing a January gardening show, you only have about 10 minutes left to make your pledge. I need 10. I want to see 10 people who say, give me a January gardening show. Otherwise, it's mid-February, and then we're back to our schedule. But
what happens if you get 20?
If we get 20, we're still doing one. That's a great question. And thanks for playing. Thanks for being on the show. Mark in Albany. Mark, you're on. Go.
Hi. I got two questions, probably not complicated. First is, it's no longer a problem for this year because we're so late in the growing season, but I got two trees, a crabapple and a purple leaf plum tree, that I just get a bumper crop of suckers around the bottom of these every year, and I'm wondering if there's some way that I can permanently get rid of them.
Yeah. So,
and the second question is, I'm planting a peach tree, maybe two, in my yard, and I'm just wondering if you have any general suggestions about that.
Yep. So suckers are going to keep coming on certain species of plants. It's just the nature of that plant, and some trees don't produce them hardly at all. So crab apples, apples, plums definitely tend to produce suckers. One trick that I've been able to sort of save myself some time with is that when you do cut the suckers off, make sure you're cutting them all the way down, not leaving little nubs. The nubs become really woody, and that creates a more difficult situation to manage in the future. So you're cutting them real low. And then in the springtime, when they start to grow, you can get them before they harden off at all, especially if you don't have any of the little nubs from the past years, just new growth. It's so soft and succulent that you can get a pair of work gloves and just kind of smear them all. And then some of them will survive, and you'll see a few shoots, but you're going to get a lot less shoots coming up. So generally speaking.
I have a number of crabapple trees in my yard, and there's only one, and it's not. There's only one that produces these suckers.
All right.
And then I've got this purple leaf plum tree that's got the same
problem. Okay, so those two, I would handle those two, I think, more like that, you know, in terms of cutting them low,
yeah,
letting them come up, smear them when they start to grow, and then...
Smear them with what?
I use a work glove. It's just, you'll see a ton of suckers coming up. It's so soft and succulent in the springtime that you can get a work glove and just kind of crush them all. And now, oh, instead of tons and tons of shoots, you only get a few shoots, and you get less growth. Is it, you know, are you still going to get some? You are, but you get less, and it's just easier to manage.
It's only a couple of trees. Just keep up with it.
Yeah, keep up with it too. Cutting them low also helps. Keep it, you know, cutting them high, I see a lot more regrowth.
They just grow. They grow as fast as I cut them.
Are they coming right off the trunk? Or are they coming out of the soil around the trunk?
I'm pretty close to the trunk. As close as I can get.
Some, you know, sometimes if. They're coming up out of the soil on their own. They're coming off a root that you may want to, you know, kind of excavate a little bit so that you're cutting that stump shorter. You're
shorter.
Well, you know, well.
If I carve them out of the trunk, will that help?
Well, it wouldn't be coming out of the trunk, right? Yeah. It would be coming out of the ground.
Yeah, if it's on the trunk, you can just go to the trunk. You don't want to be creating.
Yeah, you don't want to gouge into that if that's the case. And to answer your peach questions, I'm sure we all have recommendations, but the top two that I like for the Northeast is a Cold Hardy Flaming Fury, which is
hybrid. That was a horse race, I think.
Well, you know, it does produce some of the largest peaches in the world.
Really?
So,
what was that?
It's called Cold Hardy Flaming Fury.
In front.
And then Red Haven is another one. And I believe the Cold Hardy Flaming Fury is actually a hybrid of a Red Haven, and they're both really, really cold hardy. There's a lot of other good ones.
We do well with the Reliance, too.
And that's an old standard.
That's an old standard.
Yep.
You know, the same thing we say about fruit trees always is put them in the sun. Don't put them in the shade.
That's right.
I'll name one more. It's called Contender.
Yep.
And it's a nice new one that's very hardy and good, you know, good yellow peach.
These are all racehorses names. I mean,
they
really
are.
You could go to Saratoga and... All right. Well, I think we have time for one more. Maybe a minute and a half, 90 seconds for Patricia in North Bennington. Go.
Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
So my question is about dwarf fig trees. I have three that are currently on my deck. When do I need to bring them in, and do I need to gradually bring them from the deck to a breezeway with maybe low heat and then into the house? I still have one tree that has three figs on it that are still growing.
Yeah, you don't need to acclimate them, but because you have fruit, you don't really want it to freeze. You don't want to see 32 or 20 or 31, I think. And so moving them to a covered porch, you know, could allow you to leave them outside for a little longer and protect them enough from the first few frosts that we might get. But if you can't do that or you don't want to do that, you could bring them right in today.
Okay.
Okay. Well, and do I prune them?
So what figs
they
do?
A lot.
What figs? You can prune them anytime. You know, you have some figs, so you don't want to prune those ones off, of course. But you bring them in. They continue to grow and live and maybe fruit a little bit for a while. Then then they'll start to drop some leaves after a month or so, and then they might put out a couple more. But somewhere in December, January, just like the sugar maples out there, they'll drop every leaf. They'll be done. You'll just see, just have sticks. And at that point, you can just hold back on water and wait. And then it will, all of a sudden, 6 weeks later, give or take, leaf right out again.
Okay.
So any time in there, once you've eaten those figs you have, and even after they leaf out in the spring, you could prune them any way you want.
All right. Well, that is where we're going to have to leave it. Well, fellas, we'll either see you in February or
January.
If up to 10 or over 10 people say, I want to have, with their pledge, say, I want to have a gardening show, we'll do it. You got to go to WAMC.org and you have to do it very soon. I'll tabulate them. I'll let you know tomorrow. Now, listen, Greg, this was your big idea.
Yes.
So if it comes January and we have to do a show and you say, I can't do it, I'm on vacation, I'm coming for you, man.
Schedule a vacation around that show.
Right, just let me choose the day.
Oh, you get to choose the day.
Oh, now he wants to choose the day. Right.
We'll make it a Thursday.
Can I choose the week?
Possibly.
Okay.
Not Fred Breckley. Bob Graves, how do we find out about Fatigan's?
We're on the Troy Schenectady Road, 2.5 miles west of the Northway, near the Airport Road, and it's fatigannursery.com.
Greg Ward, Ward's Nursery.
Yeah, Ward's Nursery, 600 South Main Street, Great Barrington, wardsnursery.com.
And Fred Breglia, the Landis Arboretum.
Yeah, and we're at landisarboretum.org, located at 174 Lape Road in Esperance, New York, and colors are looking really good. Come pay us a visit.
You know what? You guys are great. Thank you, and we'll see you when we see you, and I will check with Greg before we book any shows. Support comes from Acres Alden Country Real Estate Services, a holistic transactional real estate brokerage serving the Berkshires of Western Massachusetts. BerkshireAcres.com for information. At Curtis Lumber, offering virtual bathroom design services featuring Merillat cabinets and Cambria quartz countertops. Consultations available, CurtisLumber.com. Once again, thanks to Fred Breglia, Bob Graves, and Greg Ward for being here. Tremendous calls. Lines were loaded at the end of the show. I didn't get to a lot of you. Tons of emails. They'll be back eventually. That's all I can say. Thanks to Zach Malloy, our engineer. The great Peter Hughes from the Linda screened the calls today. Thank you, Peter. I'm Ray Graff. Tomorrow on Food Friday, we talk farm to table and catch up with Chef Josh Kroner. That's tomorrow at 2. See you then.